Yeah, no, I'm doing good, man. It's good to see you.
Yeah, you too. It's been a little while. Last time we were having a bit of a debate on the Wilson documents, which was fine. I enjoyed that. And now we're here to kind of discuss your recent findings.
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to it. I truly think that that interview serves as kind of a testament of what this field should be, you know, but I always find myself encountering those that don't agree with that.
Yeah, don't we know it? Don't we both know it? But yeah, it's an unfortunate truth within the UFO community. You know, there's quite a lot of division, and I agree with you. I think our discussion just showed that people can have different opinions and still have a respectful conversation and not come down to ad hominem attacks. And there's no problem with differences of opinion.
Yeah, no, I totally understand. Before you get going, if I can ask, do you want me to share this slideshow? Do you want to bring up something and we're talking together?
Yeah, so I was going to say to you, if you're going to do a little bit of a talk about it, first of all, it might be best for you to be in control of the slides, unless you want me to do it. It's up to you.
Doesn't matter. I just want to make sure that I have it up for you here.
Cool.
I know it gets kind of dry. Like, I have the slides here. Let me just scroll through and make sure I've got one slide. If you want to talk about like the exemptions, like why things are blacked out. I don't know if you want to go into that. It's all up to you.
Well, to be fair, there's actually, I think there's a listener question that's around that. So we can talk about that when it gets brought up in the Q&A.
Okay. It says that you have sharing disabled.
Sharing disabled in terms of, oh, I might need to give you permissions. One second.
I've been having some rain here.
Oh, really?
Finally let up today.
Well, we've been, for the first time in, probably about 10,000 years, we've had sunshine in the UK.
Oh, really?
So I've been...
Polar opposite here.
Well, this is the thing about the UK. So we've had sunshine and it's been lovely and warm. I've been out in the garden, and now in the next couple of days we're expecting snow. So that's just very, very aggressive spectrum of weather that comes through England. You know, we just usually get wet and rainy, a little bit of sunshine, but it never lasts that long.
Where I'm at is just sun. So the rain, it's like everybody panics. They don't know what to do.
Okay, this should give you permission now. I've just put it onto multiple participants can share, so you shouldn't have a problem now. Right, well, before we get into this, just for people who might not know about you, John, do you want to just tell people who you are and what it is that you do within the research community?
Sure. So for the last over 25 years, I have run theblackvault.com. Essentially what that is a online repository for declassified documents. What I do is through what's called the Freedom of Information Act, here in the US, I can request information. And as long as it doesn't fit into 9 different exemption categories, then they have to release it. That's the catch, though, is it's very hard sometimes to circumvent those exemptions. But the Black Vault is kind of it's everything that I have done. What I try and do is not hide anything. I try and be as transparent as possible. So it represents my entire research, essentially, is where I'm going with that. It is a website that I modeled after something I was looking for when I was 15 years old and never found. And so what I did was I started building it, and back in the beginning had essentially typed in documents by hand because I couldn't afford a scanner. And after quite a few hundred pages of archiving government documents in that way, finally got a scanner donated to me. And what you see today is the evolution from that point to today. And I just go after information that the US government does not want us to know.
Yeah, it is a fantastic website. Links will be in the description box below for anyone who hasn't checked it out. So I would definitely recommend checking out the Black Vault. Now, most people listening will be aware that last year, the Office of the Director for National Intelligence released a preliminary assessment on unidentified aerial phenomena, UAP, more commonly known as UFOs. This preliminary assessment was, pretty boring and bureaucratic, but it did highlight that there was a large number of cases that remain unknown and require further analysis. So you have been trying to get more information released via the Freedom of Information Act. And because we were made aware that a classified version of this report from ODNI had been created. So what exactly have you managed to get hold of here, John?
So the morning after the public report was released, which was that 9-page kind of huge letdown that we all wanted to see something and didn't see a lot. My quick kind of reaction to that, though, is although it was a letdown, there were some gems in that public report. But as you mentioned, I knew there was a classified version. So I filed what's called a mandatory declassification review request. And essentially what that is it's very similar to the Freedom of Information Act, but in a very quick nutshell, because it can get kind of dry. The difference is that this requires an agency to take a classified either document, video, or photograph and requires them to review it for release. The Freedom of Information Act, sometimes it's kind of a gray area. It doesn't really require them to do that. So although I'm not a fortune teller, I think that if I filed a FOIA for that report, it likely could have been rejected, saying that the whole thing was classified. But since I did it through a code of federal regulations through the federal government here in America, it required them to immediately take the document and put it under a security review. It took until this last week to get that done. So from June of 2021, here towards the end of March of 2022, which is actually not that long of a wait, as long as that sounds. I mean, I've waited years. My record was a 14 and a half year wait for a Freedom of Information Act request. So they can take their time if they want to. But what this did was it extracted the classified report with redactions, of course, but that classified report came out and we were able to get a glimpse into what was given to Congress in a classified setting versus what the general public got with the public report.
Yeah, so I think it's probably best if I kind of give you the lead here to start with. We won't go through the entire document page by page because some of the redactions are quite self-explanatory, obviously pertaining to sensitive sources and methods. But there are some intriguing redactions in this release. So if you want to take us through some of the more interesting pages, I might chime in here or there if I want to ask you something. But then we can kind of jump into some of the questions after you've wrapped up.
Sure, absolutely. So you can see my screen okay and the laser pointers coming through?
Yep, it's coming through fine.
Yeah, so what I did was I created a PowerPoint presentation. I did a much more full video. I called it a deep dive. I don't do those often where I really get into the nitty-gritty. But for those interested, I really go line by line and talk about stuff that I know isn't of interest to everybody, but it is very interesting to kind of juxtapose the public version to the classified. But on the right side of the screen would be your public version. And then the left side was the newly released document that I got, again, with redactions. These up here, just in case people don't know, that's the classification of the document. They redacted the classifications. We don't know if it's secret or top secret. My best guess is it's likely a top secret document with a code word. We see that in just specifically UFO documents, but a lot of different documents. With the NSA, just to give a quick example, it's top secret / Umbra. And Umbra talks about communications intelligence and is a special compartmentalization of top secret. So you have to have Umbra access. So I think that that's what this is. But where I want to start, I think, is for me a very intriguing but very small redaction, which was essentially on the first page or page number two past the cover, which is this section here, which is a redacted agency. They don't want to tell us one of the government agencies that contributed to this report. Now, when you, again, juxtapose it with the public version, most of the agencies were there. So they told you, you know, who contributed to the report, the Army, the Air Force, the NSA, the Navy, DARPA, FAA, a lot of the ones that we would imagine would contribute. But absent here, which a lot of people noted when the public version was released, absent was the CIA. So a lot of people are asking, you know, is this the CIA? And we don't know. It's speculation. Why wouldn't they tell us? Well, the CIA may have intelligence that was shared that maybe they didn't quite have the authority to either collect or have or house or whatever. So again, pure speculation there. But for me, it's intriguing. You know, I know you did an interview recently with a former Navy man that talked about the NURO.
That was one I was thinking of. It might be the National Underwater Reconnaissance Office, but again, who knows? We have no idea.
And that's a great guess as well, you know. And it is that agency, which we know is an operation, but they won't admit it. Is that collecting data when the Navy's out doing their exercises or whatever it may be? What intelligence that do they have? So that's definitely a possibility. Character count could definitely fit CIA. Doesn't matter, but I'm super intrigued by this. I filed an appeal this week on the redactions that we're going to see a lot of, but my appeal aims to get a lot of these lifted. So I'm going to see what I can do. If they don't want to admit to the agency, though, it's probably, you know, not going to amount to much. But another quick note, Marine Corps was in the classified version, but not in the public report. Maybe an oversight or an error, who knows? NASA as well in the classified version, but not in the public report. Also of note, the Navy OD&I was not there. Here's kind of a zoom in on those paragraphs. Navy O&I was in the public report, but not in the classified, likely, which is the Office of Naval Intelligence, likely just an oversight. So probably not a big deal. But the NASA inclusion and Marine Corps were definitely interesting. So moving on from that, this is where you start to see some minor differences. And I think it should be kind of quickly said why redactions occur. And it's not just if they don't want to tell you they redact it. There are certain citations that you have to give in a legal response like this to tell me, the requester, why they're redacting something. And a lot of what we saw were what they considered vulnerabilities or capabilities of our systems. And this was, you'll see these citations here. I'm not sure if they come through on your monitor real good, but you'll see these 1.4 and then in parentheses, A, E, G. Those are all citations. Again, gets very dry. But when you really kind of sit down and evaluate it, you start to see why they are redacting certain things. And you also see, in my opinion, them trying to redact certain things with their citations, but it likely doesn't fit. So meaning they're really not following the letter of the law. They're saying, oh, yeah, we're redacting because of this. But in my appeal, I've put up a case that they might be not as fitting as they want us to believe. So you'll see here in some of the pages, the extra information in this one, there's not a whole lot. It talks about in a limited number of incidents, UAP reportedly appeared to exhibit unusual flight characteristics. And in the public version, that's where it stopped. In the classified version, it goes on. It says, including several in which the... And then it's a redacted line involving, and then a more redaction. So someone might look at that and go, hey, we're not really learning anything from that. And you're right. But again, this gives an indication of, in a classified setting, what Congress is getting. And it's those additional details about UAP that they don't want us to know. And the question is, why not? Because if we're dealing with a mundane explanation, drones or some kind of classified tech, sure, they're not going to tell us what country it comes from or the identifying markings or likely even what it looks like. But when you really start looking at these redactions, the question is, why would they withhold some of those characteristics in a general sense? You know, and for me, that was one of the parts of my appeal that I put up to them was that's not encroaching on any threat to national security, and that shouldn't be classified. And one of the biggest things that I kind of attacked with that argument, we'll get into it in a minute, but the shapes. And yeah, that was, yeah, I think, the most widely criticized by the general public redaction that they had, which is not even telling us the shape of what UAP are or what the common shapes are. And you'll see here, and again, I don't know how much detail you want me to go into, because again, I know sometimes it gets a little bit dry, but you can see here, under the available reporting, largely inconclusive section, limited data leaves most UAP unexplained, goes into a lot more detail. And some of these redactions, although are frustrating, we have to understand are likely acceptable, that the United States military just doesn't want to give away their vulnerability. So if UAP has certain characteristics that can evade our radar systems, our sonar systems, whatever may apply during the case, we don't want to give that to the enemy. So I kind of wrestle both directions with this. Of course, I want to see under the redaction and see what it is. But in the same respect, I can understand that level of security where you reveal out there, hey, if a craft has this characteristics, it completely evades our detection capability, can fly right in, and we don't even see it. So gray area for me in this particular section where it breaks down the 144 reports, the 80 reports involving observation with multiple sensors, that although that was in the public version, you can see here it's expanded, including, and we don't know what, but obviously sensitive systems that they don't want to tell us about. And I think that what's important about those types of redactions, again, you're not learning the systems, but it's showing you that these aren't pilots coming forward with a story and that's it. We're talking about pilots coming forward with a story, but you have multiple sensors, even up to a classified level, highly sensitive, that are seeing and essentially verifying that these sightings are taking place. So that's what's key about these redactions. Frustrating, but you have to look at it and go, oh, okay, now we see that there is a lot more, that they named the systems that are seeing these UAP, that we are detecting this, likely taking photos and videos, which are mentioned in this classified report and not redacted, that there are photos and videos. So you look at that and there's a much, much bigger story to tell about this UAP topic. Going through here, this section, UAP collection challenges, I would safely argue that a lot of this is our system here, kind of big chunks of redacted information, but, again, probably an acceptable redaction here. Potential patterns do emerge. This was the start, I think, again, of the most frustrating part. The most common shape described by military personnel and their reporting was a
redacted.
Right. So I mean, just pick something, a circle, tic-tac, oval, pyramid.
What do you think might be the most commonly cited?
That's a hard one. It really is, because I don't know the full extent of the data they collected. You know, you go to a public report like a MUFON or a National UFO Reporting Center, that data, I don't want to call it biased. That's probably not the right word, but biased in the sense that it's going to lean towards certain shapes is where I'm going with that. So not biased in the research angle, but rather weighted to the general public seeing a saucer-like cylinder shaped, whatever it may be. The military may be something different, but you can see here that it's not a huge redaction. So there's not many shapes beyond just a simple shape that can fit in there. If it was a big redaction, for me, what I put up in the argument is, if they say the most common, it doesn't make sense, but I'm just kind of speculating here. If it said the most common shape was, a circle with four rotors and an engine, and it looked like, essentially a drone, is where I'm going with that, you wouldn't have that small of a redaction. So it's
So we're talking like spheres or squares, triangles, like maybe sources. Yeah.
Exactly. So then the question mark is, why would they remove that? Now the citation, and I argue this in the appeal as well, was what's called 1.4A. What that means is it's military plans, weapon systems, or operations. That's it. That's the descriptor. So what about a shape fits into that? And I don't know, because you may lean towards, oh, well, maybe it's part of our weapon systems. Maybe it's part of our operations. Okay, then they'd be able to identify it.
Right.
And that's, again, something I put in the appeal, where it's like, look, this clearly isn't us, because you said it's not because I'm making it up, but you guys couldn't peg a single case. So you're redacting a shape based on military plans, American military plans, weapon systems, or operations. Well, that doesn't fit. And so that's in my appeal to argue, saying, hey,
right,
not legitimate. So, sorry, I didn't want to cut you off yet.
No. I was just saying, like, I hope you can actually get those shapes out. That would be very interesting to see what they've put down on that.
That's my biggest finger cross moment in the appeal, is because I think I have the best case for that, but we'll see. Going along the same paragraph, though, military aviators describe many of these blank objects as blank, or and when I say blank, I mean redacted or redacted that redacted. Several sightings were redacted and resembled redacted. Obviously,
I'm sensing a pattern here.
Yeah, exactly. So they don't want to give you any indication of what they look like. But again, when you evaluate the redactions, they're not very sizable, which means that I don't think that they really have a case to redact that. And so that's what I'm aiming to kind of get lifted. But you can see that they're just withholding all of the characteristics visually from these UAP, and I just don't think they should. Sensors and sensor systems and vulnerabilities, okay, I can buy that and reluctantly accept it, but not on the shapes. You can see on this page too, quite a bit more information. This is also where it kind of gets interesting, where they talk about some of the cases. And this also differed extensively from the public version, where they dissect and give some of the details of the pilots. You can see here about halfway through. Well, here, before I get here, you can see on this section here, a few of these reports describe UAP behavior, and then it redacts the behavior. So again, reinforcing that all the characteristics, their behavior, visual sightings, they don't want us to know. Down here, recordings of radar displays suggest these UAP, and then obviously redacted. So radar confirmation, again, that was kind of a given, but you know, this just reinforces that as well, and to the extent in a classified setting they go. Here's another branch out of their stories. I won't just keep saying redacted, so I'll drive you nuts, but let me see, a Navy pilot, they didn't want to talk about the altitude. He noted the winds aloft were greater than, and then it redacts the speed. He was, quote, fighting to keep his aircraft in the airspace. And then it comes, and that was a quote in this document. So they must have pulled that from the pilot testimony. And it appears in this next line that it's likely the UAP position was unaffected by the, and this redaction doesn't make sense to me. Very small. I'm wondering if it says wind.
Yeah, because I was thinking the wind speed, because it was talking about the wind speed previously, but it's quite a small redaction. You're right.
So, you know, if the UAP is unaffected by the wind, that could fit, but why did they redact it? The reason for it were military plans, weapon systems, or operations, and also vulnerabilities or capabilities of systems, installations, infrastructures, project plans, or protection services. So essentially, they're just kind of citing a couple things. For me, such a small redaction to have that much cited as why it's redacted doesn't make sense. So you know, that's obviously another one I honed in on to try and fight. But you can see here that although we get those little details, they don't want to tell us about what the pilot did or what the object did. So this last line here obviously probably summarizes and closes the case for Congress when it comes to the storytelling, but we don't get to know what it is. You'll see here a Navy report documented, again, lots of redactions, but then appeared to change course and speed. So obviously we got redactions on the front and back of this, but this is obviously giving us intelligently controlled indicators here. So frustrating, but take those words and start to dissect that we're dealing with something that, you know, is not a trash bag flying in the wind or some, you know, balloon, that we're talking about changing course and speed. So we're talking about intelligently controlled. Here's another one, a UAP exhibited redaction. The UAPTF has, this is likely a number, however many additional reports of aircraft indicating redacted that appear to redacted. So again, more of those characteristics they don't want to tell us about. Let me see. You see a lot of other changes as well from the public report. Here's another one about a helicopter pilot. Somebody had told me, I believe that this is a new case. Of course, I could be wrong. It just doesn't ring a bell to me and hasn't since I got this report. Somebody had told me that a helicopter pilot was interviewed in unidentified. I don't recall that scene or that interview, but who knows if it's the same. Regardless, you know, here's a documented helicopter pilot with two weapon system officers or WISOs that also had experienced the encounter. So multiple witness cases. So all of this was not in the public report. So although those redactions are there, and I don't mean to beat that dead horse, where we have that frustration, you look at this and you start to see a glimpse at what caliber of cases they were collecting.
Yeah.
And I have seen those skeptics come out on social media about this report And they say, well, you know, a lot of it seems like stories, that it's just stories. But when you look at this, you realize, well, it's stories, but in combination with multiple sensor systems, in combination with some details that they don't want us to know about. And if it was just a story, I highly doubt that they would go to this level of redaction.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And the helicopter story, the only one that I can actually think of is one that was actually, I think it was on the Joe Rogan Experience, and it was Commander David Fravor. You might remember he was telling a story about how one of his buddies was in a helicopter, and they were doing some sort of like telemetry testing with these dummy missiles that they were putting down into the water. And so they were above the ocean, helicopter was kind of loitering above the ocean, and they were bringing down this kind of weapons cage, and a shadow kind of started to arise up, and then this torpedo got sucked underwater. So I'm not sure if it fits with the context, because I can't actually read the paragraph. It's too small for me to see on the screen right now. But if there's enough redactions for it to be telling that story, it could potentially be that one.
That's interesting. I didn't think about that one. And then just to add to that speculation, then it kind of reinforces why the NURO would be involved in the classified version of the report versus public. But that's a great thing you brought up, because I didn't recall that part of his interview. But these are gems. These are golden nuggets here in the report that allow people like me to now know for a fact that there was were these cases that, again, we don't have all the details, but we can cite this document. So from a legal sense, that's what I look for in records like this, because you can now use this. This is irrefutable. It has come out through legal means. It's not a leak. It's not anything like that. And I can use this, and just for using this as an example, although I have open cases for this already and have for some time that would yield this. Regardless, this is an example where you hone in on that helicopter encounter, cite this document because they can't refute it, and say, give me everything you got on this.
Right.
And there's nothing they can do to fight it. They come back and say no records. You have a golden appeal already written because it's here. So that's what's gold about this, and why I love getting stuff like this, because it really does pave the way to getting more. You know, absolutely. I mean, this isn't it. It just paves the way to getting more. So moving on, and I mean, I'll go through this quickly because I don't know how much you want to spend time on it, but these are the...
Happy with listening. It's quite interesting hearing you break
it
down.
Oh, good. All right. I'm glad I didn't put you to sleep yet. The section on the UAP probably lacking a single explanation, there was some interesting additions here, namely about airborne clutter. And you can see the juxtaposition with the public report where it essentially just tells you, you know, a possible explanation for UAP, airborne clutter. These objects include birds, balloons, recreational unmanned aerial vehicles or UAVs, or airborne debris like plastic bags that muddle the scene and affect an operator's ability to identify true targets such as enemy aircraft. So that, I mean, that makes sense. They couldn't peg a single, I take that back. They did the one case with the balloon, but I mean, like the debris and trash bags and stuff like that. Obviously, that was all just kind of fluff because they didn't have any cases for that. But the balloons, they had one case. That was the only case that they could identify that fit into this category. But you can see in the classified version, they go into a lot more. And when you talk about a category that includes birds, balloons, you know, unmanned aerial vehicles, essentially a toy drone, even commercial grade drones would fit into this, or airborne debris. What are they adding here? This category can also include, and then a bunch of redactions.
Boxes. Yeah,
this one didn't make sense to me. I don't get it, because why couldn't they tell us this? There's nothing classified there. This is all more just regular kind of silly explanations for UAP, but it could happen. Obviously, they saw it with the balloon. Then they say we recognize that. And then it's redacted with the, and then...
Well, it's when you find out that the NSA has a drone program where they use model birds to fly around cities and spy on everyone.
Well, I mean, joking aside, I had just done, it just aired on television here in the States. Hopefully you guys will get it in England, but it's called Black Files Declassified, and it's on the Science Channel here in America. And I believe some of that goes over to...
Yeah, some of it does.
Yeah, and we talked about this back in the 70s. The CIA were creating drones, literally like the first real made drones that looked like a dragonfly, and it was called the Insectothopter. And my connection to the story was that I got some of the original documents released on it. We had known about the technology, but the documents and some of the schematics and designs and stuff had never been released before. And so I had went after them. So I bring that up only to say, like, this was in the
It's
1960s and 70s.
it was in the pipeline, man. So if it's happening then, like, what's happening
Yeah,
now?
and that to me is why some of the, and even UFO related and beyond, why some of that older stuff is so fascinating, because you look at that, you can see what you can confirm 40, 50 plus years ago. It makes you wonder, what do they have today? And you're absolutely right. You
That's
nailed it
it. That's it.
on that type of technology. But you can see here natural atmospheric phenomena had some additions as well, even some redactions. But what was interesting to me was this paragraph here. Although we cannot definitively classify any UAP occurrences in our data set as caused by atmospheric phenomena, we also cannot rule out the possibility that these factors may account for some of what the pilots have observed. What's funny to me is, like, yeah, we couldn't prove any of it, but it could be true. Well, of course it could be true. You have it in the, it's a possibility, but it's so silly and simplistic for no reason. But you can see they took that
We
out of the
have
public.
no evidence of it, but you know, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. That, who cares about the evidence thing? Some of the skeptics' favorite categories, the United States government or industry developmental programs, essentially top secret tech. That was echoed in the public report, but you can see here that there's an extra paragraph primarily redacted. We have, and then there's about five lines redacted. So that also, I think, is intriguing that they could not peg a single one as a US classified tech. I don't know if you want to talk about this. I'm happy to, because I do get the question a lot that I have spoken on television about the possibility that some of these, some keyword, are classified tech. And I get a lot of heat for that. Namely, I've brought up the Nimitz encounter. So I don't know if you want to.
I don't know why you get heat for it, because quite frankly, I think it's perfectly reasonable to say that some of these could be experimental technologies. I mean, at the end of the day, I don't, people don't have to be too frustrated with something like that. That could still mean some very strange, suspicious technology that's been sequestered away in a black project for years and maybe acts and looks like a UFO. That's still exciting news, and it's still something people should know about. So I don't really know why people would dismiss that. I think when you're dealing with a phenomenon like this, it certainly seems that there's a spectrum going on, and that spectrum seems to contain quite a few different types of examples of different phenomenon. And I think, yeah, absolutely, experimental aircraft and exotic propulsion systems, that could absolutely be part of this.
And that's why I enjoy talking to you, because I think you see that possibility. I think there's apprehension to accept that, because, and we'll focus in on the Nimitz encounter. That I think, when I had been asked that by J.J. Abrams, did a documentary for Showtime here, and it was asked specifically about it, and I posed that possibility, and I still stand by it. You have to accept it. You just have to. And we also have to accept that in this report is not gospel. And what's funny is that a lot of people that will throw that heat are saying, the government is lying, they're not being truthful about this, which I agree and support. I mean, I've fully no disagreement here. But in the same breath, they'll say, see, I told you this can't be classified tech because this government report told me that. I was like, well, wait a minute. In the last breath, you just said, they're nothing but liars. So for me, I just approach it from an investigative standpoint that I cannot 100% definitively say that the UAP task force had carte blanche access to everything, that they could just walk into any special access program or anything like that, gain access to it, cross-reference any dates, times, photographs, or whatever, and peg that. So although I can bring forward the realization of what they said and find value in that, I also have to accept that they may not have had the access
Oh yeah,
that
I
we think
don't
they
think they
did.
did. I don't think they did. I mean, even Luis Elizondo said the same thing, and they didn't they change managerial there was a managerial change within the UAPTF and kind of shuffled the cards up, and there was someone who had quite a bit of knowledge, or at least was a little bit more capable of doing this, who was removed from the UAPTF prior to them having to generate this report. So I think there was some sort of skullduggery going on with that. So I mean, yeah, I don't think these people had that kind of access. And I think with the, especially with the Nimitz, I do find it really interesting. In fact, there was someone, you know, someone who had got in contact who has an intelligence background, who said that it could be some form of technological readiness test, and that you would, if you wanted to test out something in an operational type of environment without the risk of any sort of live firing and shooting down, you would do it in an environment where you were using your most sophisticated kind of white world assets. So you got the US Navy with the Nimitz carrier strike group and the Aegis radar, and everyone's, you know, all the bells and whistles are there, but no one's armed, nothing can actually be fired, and you can basically test out an exotic disruptive platform against your most advanced warfighting assets and just see what the kind of, you know, how they deal with that and how you could maybe adapt to combat that type of situation if you were faced with an adversary that had that type of capability. So that was the way it was said to me, that perhaps it was that type of thing. And there was that strange situation with, I believe people think it's some sort of naval intelligence officers who'd come onto the deck of, was it the Nimitz?
The Air Force, yeah.
Yeah, it was Air Force guys who took the bricks and took the confiscated the data and stuff. So who knows, man?
No, you're right. Who knows? And I think that we have to accept that possibility on these cases. And I think one other thing that's worth noting, especially by those voices that come after anybody who poses an alternate theory, is that once you start saying that the, let's say specifically the Nimitz, I'm not saying it is, I think it's just a possibility, but let's just use that as the example, that if you come forward and say, hey, look, this could potentially be a classified drone technology being tested. And I don't know if you saw the show, but that was the example that I had given, is what better way to test classified Air Force technology than against the best Navy in the world, the American Navy with the best sensors and the best men and women and the best everything. Exactly. You go out there and test it, but don't do it with their knowledge. And historically speaking, I can prove we have done that before. Ironically, it was actually with Area 51. Mm-hmm. And we had flown satellites over Area 51 back in the 1950s, took the imagery and gave it to the top CIA analysts that would look at, like, let's say Soviet flyovers and stuff like that. And we gave it to them and said, okay, what can you figure out from this? But they were never told it was our base. I know that's different, but the concept is the same. You take the best of the best that you have access to, and you test what you need to test against them. In this case, the satellite imagery and their interpretation skills. In the Nimitz theory, you take classified technology, highly advanced, throw it against the Navy, see what they can do. Can they chase it? Can they detect it? Can they catch it? Can they, you know, fill in the blank? And I think that is something that we have to look at. The other aspect too is, if it's like a black budget program, no congressional approval, this stuff is going on as we know, there's your motive to hold that from a report going to Congress.
Absolutely.
Because if you start pegging things as classified tech, all of a sudden Congress is going, wait a minute, we never authorized the creation XYZ. And so you have that issue as well. But going back to the heat that's thrown, when you have that discussion about the Nimitz, that doesn't mean that every UFO encounter has that explanation. And then the heat comes back. Well, classified drones didn't exist in 1950. I was like, well, wait a minute, we're not talking about 1950. And I only bring up that silly argument because I've seen it over and over and over that people throw that. And with ufology and UFO cases like this and documents and stories, you have to hone in on it line by line, word by word, case by case. There's no one explanation. If there's anything that I can't agree with more in a government report, it's that UAP lacks a single explanation, yep, which is what, yep, this report says. So not to go off on a tangent there, but I think it has to be said that each thing has to be looked at with a microscope.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's good to highlight that because, like you said, just because you say that one case or a couple of cases could be drones doesn't mean that you're saying all cases are drones and vice versa. It could be the same with UFOs. So, yeah, keep an open mind. And something that John Ramirez, when I interviewed him, said, which I quite like and I've been using it ever since, is embrace widely but hold lightly. You know, so like look at it widely, but don't hold on to anything too tight because we don't really know right now.
Yeah. No, not at all. And I hope we can extract more information, but obviously we will see on that. Anyway, just back to the report, you can see, I don't know again how much you want me to hone in on it. Here's some of the more explanations, ongoing airspace finishing up the explanations category and different things that they broke down. This was the ongoing airspace concerns section. So obviously they expanded it here. These are probably along the lines of more acceptable redactions because it's showing our vulnerabilities. So sadly, we just have to accept stuff like that. National security challenges, obviously pretty big section there, redacted. Explaining UAP will require analytic collection and resource investment. You can see here, and I'm actually surprised at this. I guess I was going to say redaction, but it's not redacted in the public report, but them taking this out. And this particular section, given the, and then there's a redacted line, the UAPTF also plans to explore how best to leverage the capabilities of non-DOD departments and agencies to enable effective and efficient transfer of data and blank among the DOD redacted and the law enforcement community. So all they're doing here is talking about sharing information. I'm surprised that they didn't punch this a little bit more in the public report. So it kind of intrigued me on why they took that out. Again, it could have just been maybe a little bit more fluff and just an edit that whoever made the public version said, oh, let's take it out. But that coordination should be public knowledge. We should see more of that. And you'll see also in a couple pages from now, the role that the FBI plays, a much bigger role than we originally thought.
That was interesting.
Yeah. So before we get to that page, expand the collection. You'll see here, you know, redaction is probably likely our technology, our ability to see UAP. How can we expand it? Probably tying into vulnerabilities. Mm-hmm. This here, just for anybody who's looking for kind of what it's what I call FOIA fodder, and you may not even need to be a Freedom of Information Act researcher to kind of understand what I look for. Here, but these are the types of things that you can see in the public version. They had took out mission objectives defined by a Deputy Secretary of Defense action memo dated 23 July 2020. Why that's important is that memo was previously unknown. And so this revealed a new FOIA case for me, but was not the memo that we know of by the same person. I believe your name's Catherine Hicks.
Right.
Not the one that came the next year. This was something else. So in 2020, they were talking about the mission objectives of the UAPTF and likely in a classified setting. What intrigues me is why is in a classified setting, a memo like this. Obviously, other reports with capabilities and sensors and stuff like that are classified. But that really intrigued me because the removal of this and the public report indicates it was likely a classified memo. Not anymore, though, because I'm going after it.
Good luck.
Yep. I'm a challenge accepted, Jay. So the tables are interesting. There were no tables in the public version. So this is all new information. Obviously, new said lightly, just because the majority of it is redacted.
Completely redacted, yeah.
Yeah, but you can kind of glean a couple things. They probably categorize the different sightings. Just speculation here, but this table is likely the breakdown of the types of observations, maybe a pilot sighting, maybe a sensor sighting, you know, that type of a concept, whatever these categories are. Yeah. I was surprised there were only four, though. So, you know, I don't know exactly what those four categories would be other than since they honed in on military aviators, maybe it was pilots, WISOs, sensors, and so on. But you can see that the numbers were probably here. UAP detected by and then redacted. This is likely a lot of the sensors that were potentially used, the equipment. Again, that is also speculation, but likely how they are detecting it in addition to witness testimony. This is kind of an intriguing redaction in over half of the 144 reports from U.S. government observers, redacted, unidentified aerial phenomena, and then a bunch of redactions. So, you know, over half, what happened? You know, so there's a commonality there that they obviously also don't want to tell us about. Here is the most controversial redaction in all of its glory. This is the table breakdown of the common shapes and then the less common or irregular shapes that have been seen throughout the 144 cases, 143 of which were unidentified. Same deal up here. You can see not a single indicator on what these shapes are. A lot of questions come my way. Are these photos? Are they diagrams? Or both? If I were to venture a guess, it's both. I would think that here they will show some real-time captures, maybe still frames from videos or photos, but also diagrams as well. Just speculation, but if I were to venture a guess, I, in my appeal, specifically targeted this. So as long as there are no markings or any sensitive information that would indicate what sensor, what instrument, what whatever was being used and utilized, I don't believe those visuals should remain classified.
So if you're successful in getting that, then what would have been their original excuse to black box it in the first place?
So their only citation was A, again, which is military plans, weapon systems, or operations. That's it. So one of the frustrating things about these redactions is the explanations are vague. So although they can be used as an indicator, they're so widely vague, it doesn't make any sense. So my argument here is the same. If you guys, meaning the government, are telling me, hey, it's not any U.S. weapon system or classified tech or known technology that we have, then why are you redacting it under military plans, weapon systems, or operations?
Right.
Doesn't really fit. So will they have some legal jargon to fire back at me? I'm sure.
But
we'll see. In my presentation, hopefully you won't mind me throwing it in here. This was a UAP, a obvious drone, if you can't see it on your screen, a quadcopter with a camera underneath. But this was tagged as a UAP. It came up under a UAP request. So what I found interesting on this was that they don't redact two of the photos, but redact one of them. Why do I bring this up? Well, they're willing to show us drones, is my whole point. They're willing to show us, even though they can't necessarily identify this, like, oh, this is from a Chinese XYZ or a Russian whatever. They couldn't in this particular case, but it's an obvious drone. Yeah. They showed it to us. And so that's my point here to reinforce. Whatever they are redacting is probably a lot more interesting than just a quadcopter representation.
Yeah, if they're willing to show conventional platforms, then it's a pretty good signifier. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So that's why I threw that slide in there. But it's cool nonetheless. This was taken by a Snoopy team during a encounter of some kind with the USS Stout. Mm. Here's another appendix that was not in at all about the in the public version. This was about how they collect the intelligence and where UAP is coming up. They go through geospatial intelligence, signals intelligence, human intelligence, and measurement and signature intelligence. You'll see here through the geospatial intelligence, images and videos captured. So that's obviously a really big golden nugget for me, just because now we have that reinforcement that there are videos and photographs in connection to geospatial intelligence collected by the task force. That is likely. You had mentioned John Ramirez. I have had open NGA requests for quite some time. In my interview as well, the NGA came up. That's the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. And it is NGA. I've heard some people say NGIA. But it's definitely NGA. They obviously are probably connected to this part. I do have open cases with them and have for quite some time seeking any information as it relates to UAP. So we'll see how that comes up. But this is an example of the gold, where if they come back to me and say, no, we have nothing, I can appeal based on this. Now, that doesn't mean that this specific geospatial intel came from the NGA, but regardless, it's kind of obvious. and it's a good shot. So I can cite that in an appeal and say, hey, look, your own reporting says this is where the intelligence is coming from. And then if that appeal gets denied, then okay, then whatever geospatial intel is coming from a different agency. So it's just trying to track it down. But the most likely is NGA. So anyway, that breaks down. Obviously, a lot classified there they don't want to talk about. And then lastly, or one of the last ones, this is the FBI section. So brief mention in the public report, but you can see here that obviously the FBI plays a much bigger role. And a lot of that role they don't want to tell us about, which is also intriguing. Because when it comes to the FBI, they're obviously the ones that are able to have essentially a jurisdiction outside the military walls. So if there's some kind of criminal activity or anything that takes the military outside of a base or an area of operation, they have to go to a domestic law enforcement agency to essentially help out because the military can't do it. So this shows you there's a lot more that the FBI has when it comes to their involvement. So that to me was one of the more intriguing sections as well. And lastly, the definition of key terms. This was in the public report with two differences. This one's minor range fowler. A lot of people, including myself, never even heard of a range fowler, defined by U.S. Navy aviators based on observations of UAP, interrupting pre-planned training or other military activity in military operating areas or restricted airspace. That's a range fowler definition. Again, the minor difference was they had it as a footnote. I think that was an oversight versus classified had it as the term. More importantly, though, you can see here there's a term. So there's some other term and definition that they have denied in toto, that they don't want you to know anything about it. And that this is the last page. That was second to the last. Essentially identical to the public report, Senate report accompanying the Intelligence Authorization Act for fiscal year 2021. Pretty much word for word was the same. Pretty much. So minor differences, but irrelevant. You can see here, though, public report. This was the only reference to the FBI. Still referenced here in the classified version, but that other appendix goes into much more detail.
So what's the overall assessment here from you? How do you feel about what's been released? How do you feel about what's been redacted? Where are you going to take this now?
Well, the appeal's been filed to fight the redactions on this report. But what is beyond this is we know that there are a lot of classified briefings with likely a lot more material. I don't know if after this report was given to Congress, who, if anyone in a classified setting reached out and said, hey, I want to know more about X, Y, and Z. So it's essentially, I often use the analogy of a tree when it comes to FOIA. And where you have your trunk, which is this report, it just branches off into 12,000 other different areas. The original 9-page public report branched off into 50 FOIA requests within about a week. Showing that there were a lot of nuggets within that I could pursue. This is no different, where you can look at this and start analyzing each line and going after that type of information. But again, looking for those follow-ups, looking for the classified briefing documents, I can now use the outcome of this case to appeal other ones. So let's say I know a small handful, and everybody knows this, it's nothing that I have that no one else does. It's the publicly reported classified briefings of different senators and congressmen and so on. So what you do is you try and track down who likely did that briefing if it's not known, and then go after the either report, PowerPoint presentation, photos, videos, everything you can. And if they deny it, I can cite this case as an appeal in my appeal saying, hey, look, I went after a classified report on this very topic. ODNI had no full page redactions. Granted, you're going to get redactions, but a full denial is unacceptable. And so that's also one of the bigger parts of this win that the general public may not really understand or even care about, simply because they don't need to use it in an appeal. But from a legal standpoint, it's incredibly valuable because it shows that you can get out a classified report and glean some information from it.
So, black boxes aside, there are things that you've got to work with here, basically.
Absolutely. And it's also reinforcement to what I've been working on in some areas, but also new leads as well. One of the big ones is the information that specifically the Navy gave over to the UAP task force would not total the total of 144, but likely a lot of them. I was denied that through FOIA 100% across the board. They said that they would not give me any of the reports, the photos, and the videos. I appealed, saying that they could not do that, and here's why. And I went specifically into the fact that I believe the FOIA brought out the official release of the FLIR, the Gimbal, and Go Fast. Granted, they had been in the public domain for years at that point, but regardless, that doesn't, in the eyes of the law, allow them to just automatically either declassify it or approve it for release. So you still have to go through that. So I was able to put up a case that there was material at an unclassified level that had been officially released, along with other legal jargon that I won't bore you with, but I won the appeal. And what that means is that the Navy had denied it, but the legal appellate authority above them looked at it and said, "Hey, look, you know what? John puts up a good case. You guys can't do that." So they remanded the request back to them and they say, "You guys have to process this." So hopefully there's some information there. That material is what was used to create this classified report. So the helicopter pilot we talked about, the naval aviator that was referenced, that all would be encompassed in that material. So hopefully that material will come out. So it's essentially, again, going back to that tree, following which branch and doing it 1,000 times over.
Well, it's fantastic work that you're doing, John. It's really, really good, and I'm so happy that you managed to get this out and that it's given you even more data points to kind of chase. And so this is exciting. I'm very excited to see where this goes. Can we jump into some listener questions?
Absolutely, yeah.
Great. And for everyone listening, if you want to join a fast-growing and friendly and informative social hub of researchers, then consider signing up to the Project Unity Patreon and gain access to our Discord server. Links for the Project Unity Patreon can be found in the description box below. Your support helps grow this platform. It allows me to put the hours in that are required to keep developing the channel, networking, sourcing new interviews, and creating content for all of you to enjoy. So please do consider supporting the channel and gaining access to our Discord community. First question comes from a friend and colleague and a guest of the podcast, Mikai Morin, and he wants to know if you're planning to investigate the Department of Energy. Mikai also said that he can provide some information on which subdepartments to look into.
Great. I'm always open to new leads. Yeah, the DOE is definitely on the target list, so to speak. I've had open cases with them. Essentially, all of the agencies in the very beginning of the report that were referenced, we kind of went over a few of them. I've targeted all of them. The DOE was mysteriously missing, but that didn't stop me from filing very similar requests to see if they did play a role. I had even filed one with the CIA on just kind of a crapshoot attempt to see if maybe they did provide something to the public version or the classified version. This was prior to this release, to see what they came out with. DOE is definitely on my list of targets as well, but I'm always open to additional information. So please feel free to reach out. I'm eager to hear from you.
Yeah, if you haven't linked up with Mikai before, I can put you guys in touch.
That'd be perfect, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So the next question comes from Henry. With all the data collected prior to AUSAP and ATIP through programs like Blue Book, Sign, Grudge, no doubt others that we're unaware of, why is the US government refusing to utilize or reflect upon this previously collected data in their assessments? Obviously, we're just kind of stuck in this 2004 to 2021.
I think that's an excellent question, but I think that I would side with the reasoning on this that they prior to 2004, they can't really talk to anybody, and the sensors and the verifying information, the corroborating evidence, all of that is essentially gone. With the Blue Book files, you really have very little evidence. I mean, you really do. I think Blue Book wasn't really an investigation at all, but that's a different story in itself and different
Well,
show. But
even John, even Alan Hynek, sorry, Alan Hynek said the same thing pretty much, that it was a
yeah.
bit of a sham.
Yeah, no, it absolutely was. So I think that data is probably just irrelevant in that way anyway. But regardless, so much time has passed from that era that I think that they were trying to figure out, and I do compliment them for this, the best of the best, or at least according to them, the witness testimony with multiple sensor verification or corroborating evidence as well to go along with it. So although it's frustrating that they wouldn't go back that far, from a research angle, it's kind of understandable because there's very little to use.
Yeah, yeah. Got a couple questions from Henry. So the next one is, given that John is a curator of a huge amount of information, does he have plans to work with people like Jacques Vallée or groups like SUFON and MUFON or any other notable peoples or groups to merge data sets on this subject?
It's a little difficult when it comes to merging data sets like that because government documents are images. And what you do from a technical standpoint is do an OCR process, which optical character recognition tries to read the material. But when you're talking about 13th, 15th, 20th generation photocopies and material that could be, you know, 50 years old, it doesn't work right. So it's a very tough data set to work with. It's not that I don't have plans for them. I've never reached out to them kind of for that reason. There's really nothing to be able to coordinate with, but also vice versa. I just don't know how beneficial it would be.
Have you ever received a FOIA and had the US government come back to you saying, sorry, we made a mistake and we need that information back, please?
Yes.
Ooh, interesting. More than one occasion.
But let me say, in fairness, it's not anything world changing,
explosive. Yeah.
yeah. I don't want to give that illusion at all. But what I will say, without going into detail of what I got, there are humans on the other end of the Freedom of Information Act process, you know, and mistakes happen. Yeah. And I respect when mistakes happen. There are others that have used FOIA responses that were given in error. Journalists with mainstream publications, I don't need to call them out, but they don't care about that mistake. And I, out of respect, had given that information back. It wasn't mine to publish. So it kind of saddens me to have seen that in the journalistic world where they went, ah, well, it's a mistake. Get it out there. Is there a legal, it's the right word I'm looking for. Is there a legal permission to do it? I guess, you know, was it legal? Yeah, arguably yes. But still, I'm not out to get anybody fired from their job and stuff like that. Yeah. So it's only happened, I can count them on one hand in 25 years that has happened.
Last question from Henry. Do you have any non-disclosure agreements with any US intelligence agencies?
No.
No, didn't think you would.
Patreon, no. I like those types of questions.
That's it's a good question. I mean, obviously, you know, you're dealing with so much FOIA stuff. It's a fair question to wonder if maybe you've had to sign a couple of things here and there. But it's good to know that you're not doing that, John.
No. Next, my only NDAs are entertainment industry for obvious reasons.
Oh, but that's fine. We don't care about that.
Yeah, no one cares about that.
So next question comes from Mike Hotel Echo. Does John have any idea how to get some of the, well, we were talking about this, some of the redactions removed, or is this likely all we'll ever see? So we now know that you're working hard on that.
Working hard on it, yeah. The appeal process is the way to go. And then we'll see how that comes out. There's a judicial review process if I want to pursue it after, and I'll cross that bridge if I have to, but essentially then you get this in front of a judge. So FOIA request or MDR first, appeal is second, judge and courtroom is next. And we'll see if that comes to pass.
Mike also wants to know if you think any sort of manipulation might take place within the FOIA process, like fabricating data, for example. Do you believe that this is a line that they would not cross, or is this something that could happen?
You know, a phenomenal question, and it's one I've wrestled with. When you go to that extent to fabricate or alter information, you are opening up a can of worms that you will likely never be able to shut again. So as much as I believe that the government is absolutely hiding information, and I can prove it with evidence and so on, to fabricate and falsify is a different level. And I don't see indicators of that. I see shenanigans for sure, and trying to obfuscate what they don't want us to know. Absolutely. But fabricate and falsify is something that I haven't seen, nor even outside of the UFO research arena. You know, the government's playing with absolute fire to do stuff like that. So I think instead of going to those lengths, they can do a overclassification. They can deny the documents. They can black it out from top to bottom. Those are perfectly legal.
As we have seen,
fight them. Exactly. Yeah. So I think that instead of fabricating or doing something that really would be illegal, they will try and get away with as much as they can, but legally.
Chris Beidle wants to know, if John had to guess, what year would he say disclosure will take place, whether it's full disclosure or a narrative-driven one? And real quick, I mean, I would say a narrative-driven disclosure is already pretty much taking place in terms of a meaningful, globally relevant and recognized disclosure. That's a different story. So what do you think, John? When do you think we'll be looking at something that people within the community would recognize as a real disclosure of this issue?
So are we defining disclosure as like a full reveal, undeniable extraterrestrial presence kind of disclosure?
I think that's what people would say is like the typical one. So let's say that's what I'll assume that's what they mean.
Sure. So the way I respond to that is with the U.S. government, we likely will not get that. I don't believe that we will. I think that there are a lot of national security implications that go along with it. I think we see that in FOIA research. Some may ask them, why do you do what you do? For me, it's extracting as many pieces of the puzzle as I can get. And as flawed in some ways that the FOIA is, it's not broken. And it can get you amazing pieces of the puzzle to help you answer that ultimate question. But for me, disclosure isn't a government thing. It's not a world government thing. It's an us thing.
I agree.
And I think that we as humanity and humans have an individual inside of us bar of disclosure. And whether that be you need documents, you need photos, you need videos, you need witness testimony, whatever it might be, it's different for all of us. So for me, when it comes to disclosure and US government, not going to happen. But that doesn't mean we're not going to get pieces of the puzzle from them to help us meet that disclosure, which is within us. And I don't want that to sound too cheesy, but I think that that's really how I define that entire part of this.
No, I agree with you, John. I think that what's come out is kind of like in terms of what's come out through the government channels, it's a blueprint for further engagement to be permitted in areas where it was avoided before. So, you know, the grassroots scientific community, we're seeing things like Project Galileo and other groups starting up that are looking into this. So I have a lot more faith in the scientific community kind of taking this on and trying to find out more about it than us getting full transparency on what the government's been up to for 70 odd years.
That's right. Yeah. And all of that plays a role in that disclosure. Absolutely. And the conversation changing plays a role in the different facets of those research angles and stuff like that. I think it all encompasses that, those facets of it.
Yeah, absolutely. So OpenItri asks, the classified report doesn't really point to a lot of satellite or radar data of tracking these objects coming from space or traveling at incredible speeds over long distances, like Lou Elizondo and Chris Mellon and others have hinted. So is the report being purposefully disingenuous, obscuring available data, or are Chris and Lou maybe pumping up the evidence a little too much?
Also a great question. However, to be fair, we have to understand that a lot of that classified report is still hidden. It's redacted, it's classified. So we don't know underneath that black when it's cited as either a vulnerability or capability of our system, are we seeing something at either 80,000 feet or coming in from space and first being detected at 80,000 feet? Those types of redactions I would understand, and they're darn intriguing to think about, but it's that gray area that I had mentioned earlier where we should know the capabilities of UAP, the origin, where is it coming from, what are the characteristics, but if you now start revealing that it was coming in from space at a high rate of speed and you tracked it and picked it up at 80,000 coming in, you know, that's that gray area where, yeah, they're justified. As cool as that story would be, I think have justification for the redaction. So to immediately just kind of go back and go, well, are they embellishing their claims? It's possible. And look, I'm a big critic of some of those bigger claims, but I think to be fair to the conversation, we have to understand that we still have a big percentage of that classified report redacted. And who knows if underneath that black, it'll reinforce what Mr. Mellon and Mr. Elizondo are saying, or will completely contradict it and put it to bed. We don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Few people ask this question, actually, and it's something I wanted to bring up with you as well. The recent lead presented by Tim McMillan, where apparently in 2016 a formal operations plan was created to address UAP, and this was submitted through the alternative compensatory control measures channels at the DoD, and two people from within this structure spoke to Tim McMillan, hinting that a portion of the operations plan may have involved attempts to coax UFOs into showing up, potentially involving the object's propensity for showing interest in nuclear materials. So first of all, what do you make of this claim? And secondly, is this something you'd be interested in trying to dig up information on?
I'm always interested in digging up information. The problem with claims like this is I have nothing to base the claim on.
Right.
Yeah. So the anonymous source thing has come up a lot here in the last week or so. And although I don't want to beat that dead horse, I'm happy to talk about it. But this is a prime example of why anonymous sources are really tough. So from a legal standpoint, it could absolutely be 150% true. But if I go and say, okay, Navy or Air Force or whomever, give me everything you have on coaxing UAP. I mean, I don't have a specific date or time. I don't have a specific program name. I don't have a specific detail of exactly how. It's an idea. And so again, maybe 150% true, but I have no source either. So if somebody were to go on the record, let's say an admiral or someone like that, and they put it definitively and say, Jay, for the record, this is what we did. That I can use. But on anonymous sources, it makes it even more difficult. So am I pursuing it? Yes, I have FOIA cases that would likely bring something like that up. But to specifically target it, it's so difficult on that because, again, rooted in anonymity makes pursuing it that much harder. And you generally can't FOIA an idea. I mean, you need to have some kind of something to go on. And again, that could be as easy as a date. I mean, if somebody said, hey, look, on the USS whatever in 2021, even the summer of 2020, give me something, then you can start honing it down and pursuing it. But the concept is very, very difficult to pursue.
Yeah, no, that's understandable. I suppose the anonymity wouldn't be an issue if they provided maybe some keywords and it was something that was actionable and you could get evidence that they were being legit. But absolutely, when it just comes to a claim was made, how are you supposed to get the specifics to kind of refine down your FOIA search? So it's difficult. So any intelligence people out there that are talking to people, feel free to email John and give him some specifics.
Yes, anything you can give. And I'm happy. I mean, the worst they can say is no.
Yeah, exactly. So next one we got is by Ron Holmes. A few more left, if that's all right with you. How are you doing for time?
No, take your time.
Oh, fantastic. All right, so Ron Holmes would like to know if John trusts the government when they disclose the few details to him that they have in releases such as this recent classified ODNI report. Is he convinced that there is information stashed away that the government categorically denies the existence of?
Well, the first part of that, I trust no one, you know, to steal
good
from
response.
To steal from the X-Files, I truly trust no one. And that includes the US government. I've challenged every step of the way for 25 years. And the reason is because there's ample evidence to challenge, you know, and the tactics that they employ to deter me from getting the information that I want keeps me going. It keeps me challenging them, but also keeps me doubting every time that they come back to me. But again, a lot of people I don't know if this is the root of your audience question here, but a lot of people were questioning whether or not I was misled with this classified report, that they fabricated the 17-page document that I got and have ignored a 70 plus page document that others have talked about. Most notably would be Mr. Luis Elizondo himself going on the record with the New York Post, actually refuting my story last year that when I had uncovered through this case that it was 17 pages, he did not want to go on the record with me, which I honored. I didn't keep pushing. His PR people at the time said that he didn't want to do that. And I said, okay, but he's out there preaching that it's 70 plus pages. So what's the discrepancy? And I absolutely meant this at the time and mean it now. If I was misled, then now's the time to go on the record and say, hey, look, here's my proof. And here's my testimony from Mr. Luis Elizondo. But sadly, he wouldn't. With the New York Post, he did. He stood by. It was 70 plus pages. And the rest is history. So that debate has raged here again in the last week. And that might be the root of that question. And again, it goes back to my explanation earlier, and I don't want to beat the dead horse for you, but the fabrication and falsification by, let's say, the Director of National Intelligence would be staggering if that was ever done. And you have too many witnesses at this point. Every congressman with a clearance to see this that was given this report would be a witness to them misleading the American people. And it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican or independent here in America, if they were to see that, I guarantee there would be hell to pay. And so there's a huge, huge, huge implication there. If you are going to say that ODNI through a federal code of regulations, that they misled me through a legal case and fabricated this, that's huge. So I don't trust to a point, but to not trust and believe they fabricate is a much different level.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, you see, the thing is with something like that is it's kind of a problem either way you slice it, because on that side, if obviously they had withheld that information from you, as you just highlighted, that's a problem. But also if they haven't, then why is Lou Elizondo saying there's a 70 plus page? And I think a few other people have said this. So I don't understand. This is the kind of smoke and mirrors stuff that I get frustrated with, because I just want people to be forthright about these things. So it's just a confusing situation.
And it's confusing indeed. And I think that there are some that maybe don't see the value in the discussion. And my only response to that, like, who cares if it's 70, we think it's there. It goes to the root of claims that don't have the evidence to support it. Mm-hmm. And if Mr. Elizondo has that, and I'm honing in on him because of all the people that made claims, I believe he would be the most qualified. I believe he has the best connection.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm a critic, of course, of everything, but I can recognize when people have connections.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It intrigues me that he is saying this. What my explanation would be, but I don't know if he would agree with this, because with the New York Post, he stood strong that it was the report that was being handed to Congress was, I believe his quote was 78. Right. I said, what if it was a draft? And what if there was a draft report by the task force? It goes to ODNI, they truncate it to 17 and that goes over. But nobody has said that. Nobody is going, oh yeah, well, it was a draft.
Cool. That's a hell of a lot of stuff to take out if it's a draft.
I agree. So, but I want to know that if there's a 70 plus, and with the connections that are being touted out there, why can't they just verify that? Because if they really want that information known, you know, and this really is a team effort, and I truly mean this, if this really is a team effort, this isn't an argument then about 17 versus 78. This is a, hey, John, you know what? I thought the 78 was going to Congress, but it was truncated to 17, and that was a draft, or that's a different version, or it's classified. But when everybody clams up and John's just the bad guy for bringing it up, that's problematic. And it's problematic in the sense that it's a very important issue, because on one hand, if it's just people throwing out whatever, that's an issue. Or if it's really based on something and it's really based on connections, then hey, let's put our money where our mouth is. Let's make this a team effort and let's figure out the answer to this. Because if we now have the 17-page document and we can glean some stuff from it, let's go after that 70 plus pager, you know, and let's do this. Let's figure out where this disconnect is. But nobody wants to do that. It's just a dig in and hey, I'm right and you're wrong and you're mean. And it's
I think people just need to remember that a critique or an observation or a different opinion is not a character assassination. It's not necessarily, you know, denoting their entire existence and removing all credibility. It's just going, hey, something was said and there's some room here for questioning it. And that's okay. That should be okay, especially within a community that prides itself on research. You know, that's kind of the point of us, right? Is to look at all the different angles of approach and figure it out. So when a discrepancy like this turns up, I think it's absolutely fine to talk about. So hopefully we get some clarity on that at some point.
Yeah, and I hope so. And I think some of the people that were involved in the conversation likely weren't qualified to be. There was one anonymous account, you know, and now I'm hearing it's a sock puppet of somebody who works with Luis Elizondo. And I really hope that that's not true. I'll be pretty frustrated if I find out that it is. But regardless, the claim shifted after I had published this report. They came back to me on Twitter. So it's all public. Mm. But they came back to me on Twitter and they said, oh, well, you know, we never said it was the seven, and is speaking very much in conjunction with Luis Elizondo. So I put it out publicly. I'm like, hey, does this guy speak for Luis Elizondo? Because now I'm getting pretty confused. You're talking about we as a team, we came right, to you right. with this claim. But regardless, the claim changed. And they said that it wasn't the report that went to Congress now. It was created somewhere else by the task force. And then down the line, you know, got turned into 17 pages. But then they started talking about the confusion behind it and that they misspoke when they said it was an executive summary. So all these excuses started right. coming. And I thought, okay, if you're this connected, right, and you have your sources or you are working in the government or whatever your claim is, why wouldn't you, like, the confusion should be on my side. I'm not involved in that. You clearly are, according to your claims. And so it shifted. And one of my last messages to them, and they've ignored me ever since, was the heat that I got last year was based on Mr. Elizondo's claim of the 78 pages to the New York Post, because that was on the record, and a few other people, but namely this account. And this account has gained a little bit of a following because they give the impression that they're connected. So again, my retort was, hey, I took all that heat and you just misspoke. Like, can you not try and bring clarity to this?
Yeah.
Because I'm the one getting attacked by people that are on Team Lou, which is fine. But now I have the receipts to show that my reporting last year was right. So now you're coming at me saying, oh, no, we just misspoke and big misunderstanding. Sorry, it's confusing. Well, no, it doesn't work like that. If you're going to make those claims, you got to back it up. And I'm sorry to get fired up there, but it's frustrating because all that heat was for nothing, right? If they're really being honest and they go, hey, look, we made a mistake, which is fine. I can accept that. There has to be some clarity there. And there's, at this point, there's none.
Yeah. Yeah. So drop back into the listener questions. I've got one by Jolly Mosh and they ask, are there any ongoing FOIA requests that John is hopeful or excited for?
Yeah, a ton. And in short, I think that the best information will be received from the making of this report, the emails back and forth, those that played a role in creating not only this, but the classified briefings as well. I love digging into emails. And for anybody who follows the Black Vault, you'll know that through that process, the FOIA process, you can get not only emails, but get a lot of information from them. I've discovered the classified briefings at NASA that had never been revealed before. Revealed that the UAP task force was the one that initiated contact with NASA and requested that the director of the International Space Station be involved. Mm. And although the space station has sensors pointing to Earth, and that could explain it, they also have a lot of other stuff that's pointed away from Earth, and I want to know if there's a connection there. So you can get a lot of those types of details that may not be in a final report, but rather will give you a huge leg up in understanding who's talking to who, why are they talking about it, and also the material itself. If there are draft documents and draft reports and so on and so forth, Drafts are a little hard to get under FOIA. Again, I won't get into the dry area. There is a legal kind of speed bump there. But if there are other types of reports that we can go after, that's what I've been doing through those cases. So, I mean, I've got a ton. Most of the ones, I would say from June of last year on the public report, most of them are still open. And most of them involve the agencies that were listed at the beginning and their interaction and communication with the UAP task force. And so that to me is going to be key because I've got it on my screen here out of the corner of my eye, but you know, when they list DARPA, what did DARPA contribute? We don't know by the report, but we know that it's not, they just sent over like three sentences and then they weave it into the report. No, they DARPA put information over there, whether it be reference material, whether it be reports of their own, whatever it may be, I'm going after that. Same with the Marine Corps, same with the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and all of that. And they have branched out into appeals. I mentioned the Navy one that's getting somewhere. So there's a lot of cases there, not to go on for too long, but I think that the cases will yield something fascinating because the classified version shows us some of the details about those reports. They're clearly unexplained. And I think that those cases will yield what those reports really were in detail. How much will be redacted? Who knows? But that's hopefully coming.
Couple questions from me just before we wrap up here.
Sure.
If you had to think of the top five most interesting, bit of a challenge here, top five most interesting documents you've managed to get released through FOIA, what would your five be? Don't have to be UFO related, just over the course of the Black Vault career, top five.
Well, what we've been talking about, I think, is one of my biggest trophies, so to speak. It wasn't FOIA, it was MDR, but regardless, for still, the sake of conversation. Yeah,
it counts.
It's the same.
Yeah.
I would say I had discovered, it's hard to put them in order, so there's no particular order here. I had extracted documents from the CIA that were connected to mind control experiments where they implanted chips into the brains of dogs in the 1960s and were successful in remote controlling them. And it tied into the MK Ultra program. And it was what was considered behavioral modification. And essentially they were experimenting with how to interface the brain of an animal to a control, you know, a remote control. I got the photographs from those experiments of the dogs that had been implanted. And I even had the charts when they were able to control going left, going right. They were able to show it was successful. When you look at that, right, and that was like the early 1960s, makes you wonder what they've got or what capability they went into. The MK Ultra program came thereafter, and they were experimenting with drugs and LSD and hypnosis and stuff like that. Those documents had been out before, but again, all that research was connected. So it really makes you wonder, during MK Ultra, what did they destroy? And we do know that they destroyed most of the research. Through those programs. So did they continue the animal research on? Who knows? But that was, I think, one of my bigger triumphs. That story was covered worldwide when I had gotten that. So definitely that's high on my list. When it comes to UFOs, I would say Air Force Instruction 10-206, prior to the revelation about ATIP and the December 2017 avalanche of coverage. This goes back to 2000. And I was able to uncover that despite what the Air Force had said for decades, they had an active publication to research, investigate, and report UFOs that every U.S. Air Force pilot was mandated to follow. I had followed this particular saga through quite a few years, showing that the publication was not old. It was actively being updated. UFOs was never taken out. NORAD, which was the one that was receiving the reports, told me we got nothing. We've never collected a single report, even though they're not subject to the Freedom of Information Act. They do have a equivalent regulation that they follow to look for information. They said, nope, we got nothing. The reason why they're not subject to FOIA is they're under Canadian control as well. Right. So I just picked up the phone and called Canada and said, hey, this is what I'm looking for. And sure enough, they admitted that they had quite a few, and I have all the proof of that. So when the Huffington Post was going to cover, they asked a very similar question, what are the top five UFO related documents? I had brought up this in addition to a couple others. And to put the story in a nutshell, Pentagon didn't want to call the Huffington Post back 48 hours after the phone call went into the Pentagon by the Huffington Post to get a comment. And essentially the question was, you guys deny UFO interest. Here's an Air Force publication showing UFO interest. What's the deal? 48 hours after that, they removed the entire section of that instruction, deleted it all, rewrote it to something about hurricanes.
No
republished.
Way.
Yeah. Republished the manual. And at when I first discovered it in 2000, it was not online. After years, the Air Force had created an online, I believe they called it like, I forget what they called it, but it was all their publications in electronic format. And I think that's what they call it, e-publications. And I was able to show the journalist Lee Spiegel from the Huffington Post, hey, you don't have to take my word for it. You can download it directly from them. Wasn't always the case, but again, it ended up being the case. That's where he had discovered that 48 hours after his phone call, it was gone. I didn't believe it. I went on. I thought he clicked on the wrong document. Sure enough, they changed the whole thing. They eventually got back to the Huffington Post and they said it was all a coincidence. So yeah, that's definitely high on my list too. And just to kind of button the story, I actually filed a FOIA about all the changes when it came to that publication, was able to prove that it was an active publication. And UFOs was never supposed to be taken out. It was only until mainstream media was gonna cover it.
That's interesting, man.
Yeah. So I know you asked for five. I don't want to keep going on tangents, but you know, those are a couple that I find as some of my biggest. I even had one that was profiled, went pretty viral. Was about the reasoning for the Iraq War and weapons of mass destruction, and had gotten a document declassified, never been out before. And one of the very few Freedom of Information Act rock stars that I look up to, Jason Leopold, saw my work and profiled it when he was working for Vice News.
Nice.
And just went viral at that point. And yeah, it was a big honor to get the mention from him, just because he is the guy. When you see stories nowadays about FOIA and lawsuits and this and that, he's now actually a BuzzFeed, but he's generally at the root of it. I mean, he knows what he's talking about. So, he profiled that one. So that's another one that's high on the list.
Where do you currently sit with the phenomenon in general? Obviously, a lot of your time is spent trying to find out what the U.S. government is aware of through using official channels of information released to the public. But I don't think I've seen you do much speculating on the nature or the origin or the intentions of this phenomenon. Obviously, it's all guesswork. But what are your current thoughts on the actual phenomenon itself?
Well, you're right. You nailed it. I don't speculate a lot. And that's by design. You know, I really like to back up whatever I say with evidence and something that I can prove to you. But to speculate a little bit, when it comes to that extraterrestrial connection, the bottom line for me, because I am a very skeptically minded person, I can't rule that out. And it's not because there's really not enough evidence. It's because there's evidence to support that a lot of what we have is not in those categories. I mean, just pulling it back to the report, in the categories that are those mundane explanations that are very likely, the military is seeing things that they just can't put in any of those categories. When you look at the totality of the evidence, not just the 144 cases that allowed them to come to their conclusion, but the totality going back to the 1940s when it comes to government documents, when you look at the ludicrous nature of the cover-up, and there's no better word for it, it is a true provable cover-up. It's the easiest cover-up for me to prove out of every government secret I've ever investigated. So there's something about the UFO phenomena that they don't want us to see. Can you attribute all that to top secret tech and stuff like that? I don't see it. And the reason is because the phenomena itself obviously is very, very old, you know, arguably going back quite sometimes even before the dawn of flight. But just talking about the modern day section for conversation sake here, you know, you're talking about what, an 80-year-old-ish phenomena that has no explanation when it comes to the government coming out 40, 50, 60 years after a case and going, hey, you know what? Yeah, that was highly classified back then, but now we can reveal to you it was this. We don't have really any of that whatsoever. And in my opinion, enough time has passed for that to happen. The government has tried it. The CIA tried to do it, saying that everything in the 1950s was the U2. And it was the most ludicrous claim, in my opinion, ever when it comes to the UFO phenomena and the US government. And the CIA was saying, well, hey, remember then, and they even did this in a tweet as well. And I'm paraphrasing, when they said, you know, remember all those UFOs in the 1950s? That was us. And they said that was us. So I filed a FOIA on that tweet, and you can actually see the internal communications. No. Yeah. So you can see the internal communications about what went into crafting that tweet. And the responsive records were literally this. Someone at the CIA, because the names were redacted, somebody at the CIA said, hey, what about this? Because it was, I think it was World UFO Day, I think it was. And obviously to a superior at the CIA. And so they say, hey, how about this? And then they did the two-line tweet, you know, remember all the 1950s UFOs, that was us. The superior, I got the response from the superior. They pretty much said, yep, looks good. That was it. That was all the research and thought process that went in it. They blasted it out. Research, though, you look into that and you realize the U2 didn't get off the ground until like 1954. So that pretty much cuts out half the decade. And then after that, nothing lined up, nothing matched up. So it's the long-winded way of saying that regardless of the government claiming certain things, it's just simply not true. So what is the phenomena? I really don't know. I do think that there are multiple explanations. Everybody always asks, is it alien? You know, everybody wants that. And I think at the end of the day, we have to deal with that possibility that a small percentage of what we are dealing with is absolutely potentially that. We don't know it yet. We don't have the evidence that we're aware of. And I always get myself in trouble when I say, I think the government is just as clueless as we are, but I truly think that they are. I don't see a mass conspiracy of communication and coordination and them concealing an extraterrestrial reality. I think at the end of the day, they truly are clueless. And I know that's not a popular opinion, but I think that evidence supports that there's a percentage of this that they just don't know. And I think that what really goes into that answer, I'm not sure if you would even want to get into, but I think what goes into that is an intelligence gap between an intelligent civilization traversing the stars for thousands of light years coming to Earth. And would they sit down and you know, talk to our presidents and make deals and stuff like that? Again, I don't think you would agree with me on that concept, but for me, I don't see it happening. Mm-hmm. I had produced a show for Discovery Channel, and I was speaking with and interviewing Dr. Michio Kaku for that. And he essentially said it one way that has resonated with me ever since, and this was years ago, where he said when that disclosure, not from the government, but disclosure where humanity realizes that we're not alone, because my question was phrased very much like you guys had asked me, when would that happen? He doesn't think it's happened yet, but he says, when it does, it will be by accident. There will be no communication. There will be nothing that comes to us and lands on the White House lawn. They will just be in our quadrant, and that they see Earth teeming with life. So's the rest of the universe. And they just keep going.
Yeah.
And that moment when we see that's that disclosure, but that's as far as he believes it would go. And it resonated with me just because, again, when you really sit and think about the intelligence gap and could they communicate? And even if they could, would they care to? Because again, you have that universe teeming with life, because the likelihood of us and maybe one or two other ones, and we cross paths, that's not going to happen. If they are there, if we see one civilization, we can feel comfortable that this universe and is teeming with intelligent life, let alone, you know, life itself. So it's a fascinating question that, again, I could bore you to death for hours with. You may not agree with it, but again, I think it's a very important aspect to the conversation, and one that plays into my thinking about what the phenomena is today.
Yeah, if we had more time, we could go on a real journey with this between our ideas on the phenomenon. But I understand that perspective, and I think for me, just my own personal bias comes into play because I have seen things, and the way in which that occurred has opened up a few novel ideas for me around human consciousness, and that's a whole other ballpark of getting into the conversation when you dilute it from the nuts and bolts down to the weird quantum entangled conscious potential. That's where I get very fascinated. But no, John, this has been a real real pleasure, mate. It's great, been great to have you on. You do incredible work, and you know, you did a brilliant job getting this report released to the public.
I really appreciate that, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you. I know I said it off the air, but I'll say it on. It's a pleasure to speak with someone who will speak with you, not at you. And even though I know we don't agree, I truly believe our conversations have served as a prime example of where I hope others will understand we don't have to always agree, but can come together and sometimes maybe even heatedly a little bit, but at the end of the day, end very respectfully. And I've always respected that of you. And going from our first conversation to this one, thank you for that. Truly. I really, really, really hope to do it again.
That's very kind of you, John. I appreciate that. And I think at the end of the day, it's like we've said before, it's fine to disagree, especially because at the end of the day, what we both can agree on is ultimately we don't know what's going on. So we have our interpretations, we have our ideas, and things come up. And yeah, we might not agree on everything, but at the end of the day, what we can agree on is we want to know what's going on. You know, that's the kind of full stop for me. So yeah, it's been absolutely brilliant. Links will be in the description box below, everyone, for the Black Vault, so make sure you check it out. And yeah, been really great. Thank you so much for coming on, John.
My pleasure, man. Anytime. Thank you.